We're happy to have Brother David and Sister Jean from Winnipeg to serve us here. There's still snow in Winnipeg if they came here to Connecticut to enjoy the weather. Brother David's topic is the Samaritans. The Samaritans. Brother David.
Thank you, Brother Dan. Even though it's cold in Winnipeg, we bring to you the warm love and greetings from your brethren in Winnipeg who all voted to send their love and thoughts to you at this time. And for Sister Jean and myself, it is so nice to be in your midst, especially spending some time with the Hartford brethren, too. We're reconnecting our fellowship and enjoying it very much. Well, brethren, the events in the history of the nation of Israel are interesting to us on many levels. Not only do we learn from Israel's prophets, priests, judges, and kings, but we also learn from their enemies. Some of Israel's enemies were providentially overruled to serve as types, while others convey to us important spiritual lessons. Our thoughts today are centered on just one of these, the Samaritans. First, we will get some background on the Samaritans, and then we will focus on the lessons that the scriptures provide us about them. Who were these Samaritans? Where did they come from? Why were they living in the land of Israel? Were they Jews or Gentiles? To find the answers, we have to reach back into Israel's history. We're all aware that the nation of Israel was formed from the 12 tribes of the 12 sons of Jacob. They originally formed one nation in the area of Canaan, which was divided up into 12 territories. After this division of the land, the nation was ruled by a series of judges. After that, they entered into a period of time in which they chose kings to reign over them. And as we recall, Israel's first three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon, they ruled over the entire nation of Israel. However, it was during the reign of Solomon's son, Rehoboam, that the nation broke apart and was separated into two separate nations. The southern half was called the Kingdom of Judah. It was comprised of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, and it was ruled by King Rehoboam. The northern half was called the Kingdom of Israel. It was comprised of the other 10 tribes, first ruled by a king named Jeroboam. Now, Jerusalem was located in the southern kingdom of Judah. The temple, the place of worship directed by God, was located there. However, this proved to be a problem for faithful Jews in the northern kingdom of Israel, who had to travel to the southern kingdom of Judah to worship in the temple. The kings of Israel didn't want their people to feel a sense of allegiance to Judah, so they established their own places of worship. Correspondingly, we find that Jeroboam, the northern kingdom's first king, fearing that his subjects would revolt and go back to the house of David in Jerusalem, had two golden calves made. He set up one in the northern city of Dan, and the other in Bethel, which was in the southern part of his kingdom of Israel, just 12 miles north of Jerusalem, but north of the border of the kingdom of Judah. And his object was not to set up idol worship. King Jeroboam wanted his people to worship Jehovah using these calves, and thus maintain control over his kingdom. We note here, however, that this was in direct disregard of God's commandment in Exodus 34 and verse 17, where it says, "Thou shalt make thee no molten gods." This was the beginning of the departure of the northern nation's departure from true religion. Now, just as a quick note for the scripture citations, I will be reading from the New Revised Standard Version. So, later on, Omri, the sixth king of Israel, built a city for himself which was called Samaria. It became the capital city of the northern kingdom of Israel. And it was in Samaria that Omri's son Ahab built a temple for Baal. And we're all aware that King Ahab and his wife Jezebel were infamous for introducing idolatrous practices into the kingdom of Israel. This false worship also provided much of the background for the distance and for the animosity that existed between the two kingdoms. Over time, the two kingdoms sometimes fought each other, and sometimes they cooperated with each other against a common enemy. But they were never united, due in part to their religious differences. We also learn that King Ahab of Israel became known as the King of Samaria, which had the meaning of king of not over just the city of Samaria, but over the whole 10-tribe kingdom. So too, the cities of Samaria refer to cities all over the kingdom of Israel. So the term Samaria soon became to be recognized as synonymous with the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, in time, both kingdoms, Israel and Judah, were eventually overthrown by land-hungry Gentile empires. The northern kingdom of Israel was first overthrown by Assyria, approximately 135 years before the overthrow of the southern kingdom of Judah, by Babylon. The prophets tell us that the city of Samaria was destroyed for its idolatry, for its moral corruption, and for its continued disregard for God and the law. The Assyrians took captive and deported into exile many of the inhabitants of the kingdom of Israel, though some were left in the land. Then King Sargon of Assyria brought in people to inhabit the deserted land of the northern kingdom. These people were from surrounding Gentile nations, who were idolaters and who worshipped a strange medley of gods. Undoubtedly, as time went on, there was intermarrying between the original Israelite inhabitants of Samaria and the new Gentile immigrants. And this had the further effect of corrupting the religion of the Samaritans. More and more, idolatrous worship was supplanting the worship of Jehovah. God was so displeased with this religious degeneration that he sent lions to devour the people. Let's read of this. It's in 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 17, verses 22 to 29. 2 Kings 17, 22 to 29. The people of Israel continued in all the sins that Jeroboam committed. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had foretold through all his servants, the prophets. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria in place of the people of Israel. They took possession of Samaria and settled in its cities. When they first settled there, they did not worship Jehovah. Therefore, the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So the king of Assyria was told, "The nations you have carried away and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the law of the God of the land. Therefore, he has sent lions among them. they are killing them because they do not know the law of the God of the land. Then the king of Assyria commanded, "Send there one of the priests whom you carried away from there. Let him go and live there and teach them the law of the God of the land." So one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and lived in Bethel. He taught them how they should worship the Lord. But every nation still made gods of its own and put them in the shrines of the high places that the people of Samaria had made, every nation in the cities in which they lived. Let's summarize what we've learned so far. The northern kingdom had largely fallen into idolatry. The majority of them had been taken captive into Assyria. In their place came people who were completely idolatrous and not Jews at all. They then requested to become worshippers of Jehovah. They asked to have a Levitical priest come and teach them proper worship. That's where we are so far. But even though they had this priest, the end result was not a conversion to Judaism. Instead, they adopted a corrupted form of Judaism, which was even worse than the northern kingdom had previously practiced. For example, the Samaritans accepted the law, but they only accepted the first five books of Moses: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and that was all. They didn't accept the Psalms. They didn't accept the prophets. They didn't accept the history of the judges or the kings as being part of their scriptures. Moreover, in their version of the first five books of Moses, called the Samaritan Pentateuch, there are differences with the Jewish Pentateuch. The chief difference is that in the Samaritan Pentateuch, God did not tell Israel to build the temple on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. Instead, God told Israel to build the temple on Mount Gerizim. Now, getting back to our history, when the southern kingdom of Judah was overthrown by Babylon, their land was left desolate, and no one else was brought in to resettle the land. When King Cyrus of Persia allowed the Jews to return, Israel and Judah were no longer divided into two kingdoms. The northern kingdom was now officially Samaria, with a different ethnic people and with a different religion. The southern kingdom became known as the whole nation of Israel, now called Judea, and its inhabitants were called Jews. This fledgling Israelite colony soon came in contact with the new Samaritans, who were in the land of the former northern kingdom. Now, when Cyrus, the Persian king, allowed the Jews to return, he also decreed that they were to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Work began and the foundation of the temple was laid. We read in Ezra 4 that the Samaritans, hearing of this, approached Zerubbabel, the Jewish leader, and offered their help, saying, "Let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do. And we have been sacrificing to him ever since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." But the Samaritans' help was flatly refused, the leaders of the Jews replying, "You have nothing to do with us in building a house to our God." This rejection caused the Samaritans to become open enemies of the Jews. King Cyrus died, and the year after he allowed the Jews to return. And King Artaxerxes was on the throne when the Samaritan leaders wrote to the king telling him that the Jews were building without authorization and were rebellious. The king wrote back decreeing the work should stop. And the work stopped for many years, until the Lord raised up the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, who encouraged the people to begin working on the temple once again. Once again, the Samaritan leaders wrote a letter to the king telling him that the Jews were building without authorization. This time the king was Darius, and he investigated the matter and, of course, found that they had been allowed to build the temple by King Cyrus. And he was angry enough to not only authorize the rebuilding, but he charged the Samaritans on pain of death to sell to the Jews all raw materials that they needed for the building and for the maintenance of the temple. Some years after this, Nehemiah was appointed governor of the province of Judah. His task was to rebuild the wall around the city of Jerusalem that had been torn down by and burned by the Babylonians. We read in Ezra 4 that when Sanballat, the governor of Samaria, heard that they were beginning to rebuild the walls, he was furious and determined to stop the work in any way that he could. First, he tried to use armed force. His plan was to have a multi-pronged attack at any of the exposed areas of the broken-down wall. Some of the Jews who lived near the Samaritans caught wind of this plan and told Nehemiah. And Nehemiah issued orders that the workmen were to do their work with one hand and to hold a weapon in the other. And he took some men off of the work detail and posted them as guards in strategic areas, thus frustrating Sanballat's first attempt to stop the work. Sanballat's next ploy was an ambush. He sent a messenger to Nehemiah and said, "Let's have a meeting about this in a small village about 30 miles away." But Nehemiah saw through their obvious plan to do away with him, and he refused to meet with them, saying he was too busy. But they tried this 4 times. So Sanballat, the governor of Samaria, went on to plot number 3. When he sent the messenger the 5th time, the messenger also had a letter with him, a letter of intimidation and false witness. Sanballat had written the letter himself, saying that it is reported, and I have a witness, that you are building a wall in order to rebel against the king of Persia. You've appointed prophets to prophesy, there is a king in Judah, meaning you, Nehemiah. I'm going to tell the Persian king about it unless you meet me right now. Well, Nehemiah prayed to God, the prayer, strengthen my hands. And he called Sanballat's bluff, as we would say, and refused to meet with him, saying, these are lies. And Sanballat was once again foiled. But Sanballat, the governor of Samaria, had one more devious plan. He paid a false prophet, Shemaiah, to speak as from Jehovah. Nehemiah had gone to the prophet Shemaiah to consult with him. And Shemaiah prophesied of Nehemiah, saying, go inside the temple and shut the doors, because men are coming to kill you at night. But Nehemiah recognized this to be a false prophecy, and that to have entered into the sanctuary of the temple would have been a sin for anyone not a Levite. And what would have this would have done would have discredited his reputation as a man of God and also as a fearless leader. And he replied, should one like me go into the temple to save his life, I will not go in. So all of Sanballat's attempts and plots against Nehemiah, against the rebuilding of the wall, were frustrated by the Lord. We read in Nehemiah 6, verses 15 and 16, Nehemiah 6, 15 and 16, that when their enemies heard that the wall was finished, they were afraid and cast down, and were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. Well, brethren, I think that we can see that the animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans runs deep. It was about this time that the Samaritans were allowed to build their own temple on Mount Gerizim to rival the temple in Jerusalem. But it was destroyed by the Jewish Maccabees less than 500 years later. Continuing our history, we know from our studies that the Persian Empire was conquered and was replaced by the Grecian Empire. And that empire was at its height of power under Alexander the Great. But Alexander the Great died in his 30s and he had no children. As Daniel 11 tells us symbolically, that great horn was replaced by four little horns. Alexander's empire was divided amongst his four generals. And Judah and Samaria were right on the border between two of these succeeding empires, the Ptolemaic in the south and the Seleucids in the north. For the next 100+ years, the Ptolemaic and Seleucid empires fought constantly with each other. And these are known as the Six Syrian Wars. Judah and Samaria were caught in the middle. With a century of wars and bloodshed, sometimes they were ruled by one, and then sometimes ruled by the other. By the end of the Syrian Wars, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids had worn themselves out in fighting. The Parthian power was rising in the east, and a new power, Rome, was rising in the west. As these four struggled for supremacy, it allowed the nation of Israel to develop a power of its own. One of the Seleucid kings, when he happened to have control of Jerusalem, desecrated the temple. And in the religious outcry that resulted, the Maccabee revolt was born. The Maccabees were a religious Jewish family that overthrew their Seleucid overlords and caused a religious revival to take place. And the Hasmonean dynasty, as it became to be called, established a somewhat independent state and even subdued Samaria and points beyond at the height of its power. One of the Maccabees, named John Hyrcanus, destroyed the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim. This Hasmonean dynasty lasted for about 100 years, waxing and waning in power. It was finally absorbed into the Roman Empire, which had defeated the Parthians, the Seleucids, and the Ptolemies. So that when we come to Jesus' day, we find Judea is ruled by Rome. We have Pontius Pilate, the governor in charge. But there still is a King Herod, related to the Maccabees through marriage, who is basically reduced to a figurehead, though still in control of parts of Judea. Now, the animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans that we read of in the Old Testament continued into the time of the writing of the New Testament. The Samaritans were not considered to be Jewish, even though they worshiped Jehovah, and even though they accepted the law. As we read in Matthew 10, verses 5 and 6, Matthew 10, 5 and 6, when Jesus sent forth the apostles, these 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions: go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And even more forcibly, we read in Luke chapter 9, verses 51 to 56. Luke 9, 51 to 56. And in this case, I'll be reading from the New Revised Standard Version, which omits the spurious parts of the text. Speaking of our Lord, it says, When the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers ahead of him. On their way, they entered a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. But they did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. When his disciples James and John saw it, they said, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" But he turned and rebuked them. Then they went on to another village. Now, brethren, with this historical background in mind, there are three instances in the New Testament where the Samaritans are singled out. And we want to ask ourselves why. Let's look first at Luke 17, verses 11 to 19. It's Luke 17, verses 11 to 19. On the way to Jerusalem, Jesus was going through the region between Samaria and Galilee. As he entered a village, 10 lepers approached him. Keeping their distance, they called out, saying, "Jesus, Master, have mercy on us." When he saw them, he said to them, "Go and show yourselves to the priests." And as they went, they were made clean. Then one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back, praising God with a loud voice. He prostrated himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him. And he was a Samaritan. Then Jesus asked, "Were not 10 made clean? But the other 9, where are they? Was none of them found to return and give praise to God except this foreigner?" Then he said to him, "Get up and go on your way. Your faith has made you well." First of all, let's just make sure that we understand everything that has transpired. If you're wondering why a Samaritan is in company with Jews, we notice it's in a border area where there would naturally be a little bit more interaction. And because lepers were social outcasts, we can assume that they were drawn together by their common trouble. Another point to notice is that Jesus was not coldly dismissing them by sending them to see the priests. As we recall from the law, priests were to inspect anyone with diseases and pronounce them clean or unclean. Therefore, the implication was that Jesus was going to heal them on the way. And we know, too, that the lepers' action of immediately going out to seek a priest without any further discussion indicated that they had faith in Jesus' ability to heal them. So, our question is, why did Jesus point out the one that was a Samaritan? Well, I think that the force of the lesson is not that Jesus was displeased with the 9 for not thanking him, but rather that he was impressed by the gratitude of the one who did. And the one was a Samaritan, who was perhaps the least likely to have caught the spirit of the miracle. For not only was he overcome with emotion, throwing himself at the feet of Jesus to thank him, but he praised God with a loud voice. In other words, he recognized that this sign or work of Jesus was of God. In particular, it shows he recognized that Jesus was sent of God. And we remember the question of some of the Jews, "Of whom are these miracles? Of God or of devils?" And so we find that Jesus marveled at the faith of the Samaritan in much the same way as he marveled at the faith of the centurion in Matthew chapter 8, whose servant was healed remotely by Jesus. As we read, "When Jesus heard him, he was amazed and said to those who followed him, 'Truly I tell you, in no one in Israel have I found such faith.'" Well, of course, the primary lesson for us is to have a thankful heart, to be grateful for all we have been given, and to express that gratitude. Another lesson seems to be, and that may surprise us, that it may surprise us to see who exercises faith in response to God's blessings. As the Samaritan was outside of the favor of God, which was shown particularly to the Jews, yet his heart was that good ground that was prepared for the seed of the gospel that was dropped into it. So too, we can't tell by looking whose heart is favorable to receive the truth. Let's turn our attention now to the second occurrence of the Samaritans in the New Testament. And that's found in Luke 10, where we're going to be reading from verses 25 to 37. Luke 10, 25 to 37. Just then, a lawyer stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he said, what must I do to inherit eternal life? He said to him, what is written in the law? What do you read there? He answered, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind and your neighbor as yourself. And he said to him, you've given the right answer. Do this and you will live. But wanting to justify himself, he asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? Jesus replied, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers, who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, while traveling, came near him. And when he saw him, he was moved with pity. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, having poured oil and wine on them. Then he put him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper and said, take care of him. And when I come back, I will repay you whatever more you spend. Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? He said, the one who showed him mercy. Jesus said to him, go and do likewise. Again, let's just make sure that we understand everything that has transpired here. Even though our initial reaction is to think that the priest and the Levite must be brutal or callous men, to not even stop for a wounded man on the side of the road, we nevertheless think that they had a reason, whether proper or not, to maintain their distance. It was a religious reason. As we read in Numbers 19 and verse 11, those who touch the dead body of any human being shall be unclean 7 days. The priest and the Levite were on their way to Jerusalem, and the inference is that they were on their way to perform duties in the temple in Jerusalem and did not want to risk defilement, which would hinder them from serving the Lord. As an interesting note, we see that the purification process for the priests would be different than for the Levites. In Leviticus 21, chapters 21 and chapter 22, it speaks of the defilement of priests. We read in 22 verse 6, the person, in other words, here a priest, who touches any such shall be unclean until evening, and shall not eat of the sacred donations until he has washed his body in water. When the sun sets, he shall be clean. And afterward, he may eat of the sacred donations, for they are his food. The priest's sole employment was serving within the temple precinct. His wage included the food offered as sacrifices. So a provision was made that if they did get defiled, they didn't have to wait the 7 days before they could be cleansed or pronounced clean and approach the altars and sacrifices that they were working with. But the Levite, who was on a rotation of service, had to wait 7 days before he could be purified after touching a dead body. The priest had to wait only 1 day before he could be purified to serve again in the temple. Now, what's interesting to note is that in this parable, the priest keeps on the opposite side of the road from the wounded man. The Levite, who would have 6 more days of purification process to undergo, at least crosses over to take a look before going again on the opposite side of the road and continuing on. In contrast, notice the Samaritan. He too seems to be traveling on the other side of the road, and he too comes near him or crosses over to take a look. But when he saw him, he was moved with pity. And this seems to be the crux of the parable, which is illustrating loving your neighbor as yourself. The priest could only think of himself, his duties in the temple, to the exclusion of all else. The Levite, looking upon the wounded man, could only think how it would affect him and his ability to serve in the temple. Whereas the Samaritan looked at the wounded man and saw his neighbor. He was able to mentally put himself in place of the wounded man. We ask, why did Jesus use the Samaritan in this parable? I want to share with you this quote from Barnes & Noble on the Bible, which I really cannot improve upon. We quote, "The lawyer had asked him, who was his neighbor? Jesus, in this beautiful narrative, showed him who and what a neighbor was. And he did this in a way that disarmed his prejudice, deeply affected him in regard to his own duty, and evinced the beauty of religion. Had he at first told him that a Samaritan might be a neighbor to a Jew and deserve his kindness, he would have been at once revolted by it. But when, by a beautiful and affecting narrative, he brought the man himself to see that it might be so, he was constrained to admit it." Here we see the beauty of a parable and its use. It disarmed prejudice, fixed the attention, took the mind gently, yet irresistibly, and prevented the possibility of cavil or objection. End of quote. Well, brethren, we can also apply this lesson to ourselves. We are all familiar with the 4 quarter marks of love, the last quarter mark of which is love for your enemies. And perhaps we have not realized the fullness of this stage of development when we're still classifying them as enemies in our minds that we are trying very hard to love. Here in this parable, we have an example of 2 enemies, a wounded Jew and a Samaritan. The Samaritan was not looking upon the Jew as his enemy. Instead, he was looking upon him as his neighbor. It is only by being able to put yourself in another's place that we can be stirred to pity and then do good to those who hate us and bless those who curse us and pray for those who abuse us. And we'll finish this review of the Samaritans in the afternoon when we look at the last instance of the Samaritans in the New Testament. May the Lord add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother David, for this lesson on the Samaritans. And yet there's more to follow on that.